again, everyone, and welcome to another edition of KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week, where we talk politics Iowa style and explore and analyze who's been making news in and around the state capital, what that news is, and what it all means. We're glad you're with us. I'm Dennis Hart, joined as always by my partner in politics, Laura Bellin of the blog site Bleeding Heartland. Laura, this is a special program for us because this is the official start of our second year on the air together with Capital Week. Happy birthday.
Absolutely. Happy birthday to you, Dennis.
Happy birthday to us. Well, no, I won't say. It is our 53rd program indeed, and we are happy to be with you, believe me. Before we start this birthday bash, we have to update your condition, Laura, because as everyone who listens to this broadcast knows, you suffered a broken ankle several weekends ago, went to the hospital, had surgery. You are back home now. How in the heck are you doing?
I'm doing okay. I'm hanging in there. I saw the surgeon on Friday. He was very pleased with how everything looks, so still dealing with some pain, which is to be expected, but we're just on track, I guess, is the expected healing process. So in a few weeks, I should be able to start trying to put weight on the foot.
You've had a tough time, and we are happy you're doing better, believe me, and it's good to see you again via Zoom. Well, this was a busy week at the state legislature, and we're going to get to that in just a few minutes, but first we have to talk about the big story in Iowa, the coronavirus. The governor, Kim Reynolds, announced last week she is soon going to end public health disaster proclamations that the state has operated under since the start of the pandemic nearly 2 years ago. Now, that includes pulling the plug on a state website that focuses data. So this is a big deal. The governor, in effect, saying, hey, we're over this. We're past it.
Yes. I mean, it's similar to a message that she's been giving periodically for at least a year now, that we need to live with the virus like we live with other illnesses like the flu, and it needs to be part of our normal lives. And the problem is that this decision to end the disaster emergency proclamation, that's technically what's going to happen next week. As of February 15th, the governor's last COVID-19 disaster emergency proclamation is going to expire. That is going to affect a lot of things beyond just whether there's a state website providing COVID-19 statistics.
Right. And this is ironic in a sense, because it was just a week ago that the auditor, Rob Sand, issued a report saying that the website's statistics they're correct. And he suggested that perhaps it should be updated more often. Well, just days later, the governor says, we're not going to update them at all.
Right. And the website, I've done extensively reported on the various iterations of the coronavirus.iowa.gov website. So I was a little bit surprised to see the state auditor's report that said that, generally speaking, the numbers were accurate. They were looking at certain numbers, the testing, the positivity rate, the case numbers, and they didn't look at everything that the website provides. So they determined that, generally speaking, the calculations of the positivity rates were accurate. They did say that the state could have done a better job explaining the methodology, especially when the methodology changed at several points. But if you go and look toward the end in the appendices of the report, there were lots of data points that the state auditors requested that the Iowa Department of Public Health refused to provide. So they asked for information related to hospitalizations, related to deaths, and related to school district cases. And the state agency didn't provide those numbers, so the state auditors were not able to verify whether those were all accurate. So, I mean, that just struck me as a glaring problem with the report, because if the agency is only providing what they want to provide, then it's expected that you would find that the numbers that they're providing were fairly accurate. And the positivity rate, I mean, there was another issue related to old tests disappearing after weeks or months, and the report addressed that in a sort of way, but I didn't feel that the explanation was accurate. It wasn't consistent with the reporting I did on that in around September and October 2020. So I still have serious doubts about the accuracy of a lot of information on the state website. That said, it was useful to have and to be able to check several times a week, and so I think it's a loss for the state that it's going away.
Part of the information the state's no longer going to collect includes information from nursing homes in Iowa. Instead, they're going to use info from the federal government. And this is, again, not necessarily ironic, but the timing is interesting, because 112 Iowa nursing homes, as of Monday, today, have coronavirus outbreaks this week compared to 86 last week. So clearly in nursing homes, the virus is still spreading.
It is, and that just shows how very infectious this Omicron variant is. I will say that the state website hasn't provided much useful information about the nursing home outbreak since about last June. They used to provide the names of the nursing homes and also the number of cases. They didn't break it down with staff versus residents. And I heard anecdotally at various points during the pandemic, I would hear from people, hey, you know, I have a relative in that nursing home, and what it says in the state website for how many cases they have is not the same as what we're receiving in the emails. So again, I have my questions about whether the nursing home data was ever that accurate. But last summer, they stopped providing the names, locations of the nursing homes, or even the county that the nursing home was located in, where the outbreaks were. So again, I would recommend Sarah Ann Ouellette's website, iowacovid19tracker.org, because she pulls information from federal databases, and she has incredibly detailed graphics for every nursing home in the state of Iowa and how many cases they've had for staff and residents throughout this whole pandemic. And again, this is cumulative data that she's been pulling from federal databases all along. So the state should have been making this data available, and it hasn't been for some time.
To go on the record, we know that the latest figures show 455 more residents and staff members were reported to be infected with the virus in nursing homes last week. 15 residents died. The biggest outbreak is at the state-run Iowa Veterans Home in Marshalltown. 92 infections there. It's the seventh outbreak at the home, more than any other Iowa care facility.
Yes, and I have a contact who is guardian to someone living in the home who regularly forwards the emails from the clinical director that they send to relatives and guardians. And so I've been seeing those daily updates. The majority of those cases have been staff rather than residents. And fortunately, it's surprising to me how few of the Iowa Veterans Home residents have had to be hospitalized. Several were hospitalized recently. Mostly they've been cared for in a special COVID unit. But it's just amazing. I don't know how that facility can function given how many staff. It just seems like every day two more staff members tested positive, three employees tested positive, four employees tested positive. And it is a large facility with about 400 residents. But, wow, they must really be struggling to keep the staffing at a reasonable level.
Right. Meanwhile, last week, the American Civil Liberties Union of Iowa asked several school districts that have dropped their coronavirus mask mandates to reinstate them or face lawsuits to get them to comply with federal law. This in the wake of that Eighth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals decision we've talked about a couple of times here on this broadcast. So now the school districts that were afraid to keep their mandates on and drop them are being threatened with a lawsuit if they don't reinstate them. You want to call that a catch-22?
It really speaks to the confusion of that Eighth Circuit Court decision, and I still haven't seen how the federal district court is going to revise that injunction on the state law that the law banned school mask mandates, and the injunction put that law on hold. So I'm waiting to see how that injunction is changed. But the Eighth Circuit decision, it caused a lot of confusion, and the ACLU said at the time, this is a victory for our clients, and this shows that the federal appeals court recognized that federal disability law requires universal masking to provide a free appropriate public education for students with disabilities. But that is not how a lot of legal counsel for a lot of Iowa school districts read the decision. And so I think we're on a little bit of a collision course. But I mean, the ACLU, this is a very important case for them. And I have no doubt that they will follow through with a lawsuit if some of these school districts don't reinstate their mask mandate.
So the bottom line on all this is that the governor has decided that we're almost beyond the coronavirus pandemic. We're going to have to learn to live with it. Democratic governors, a couple of them, made the same decision on Monday that they're going to pull off mandate. But basically, that's what she's saying. We're going to have to learn to live with it.
Yes, and several Republicans in the state legislature tweeted last week when the governor made this announcement, this is great. One of them even said that the pandemic is long behind us. I mean, it's an amazing thing to say when we still have traveling nurses helping out at hospitals because the staff shortages are so extreme. And ironically, the day after the governor announced that she was going to let this disaster emergency proclamation expire, the Cedar Rapids Gazette ran a full-page ad from the University of Iowa's hospital and clinics that was similar to ads that other hospital systems have run around the state in the last couple of months saying, please help us. We need your help. Wear a mask. Get vaccinated if you haven't been vaccinated. Get boosted if it's time for you to get a booster. Limit your social gatherings because the strain on hospitals is still very real even though it looks like some of the numbers are trending in the right direction.
And both the Register and the Ames Tribune ran a big piece a couple of weekends ago about the impact on Mary Greeley Hospital in Ames. That was a major takeout, showing the strain on everybody, including the hospital staff. And the takeaway from that was that virtually everybody who has been in there with coronavirus has been unvaccinated, that families of children and young people who have had to be hospitalized are quite upset that their kids have to be hospitalized. They are lashing out at doctors and nurses. It's really an unfortunate situation. The folks who don't want to be vaccinated are not blaming doctors when their people have to be hospitalized.
And that's what I've heard from healthcare workers around the state. The difference between now and 2 years ago is that at the beginning of the pandemic, there was this general consensus that healthcare workers are heroes and thank a healthcare worker. And it was very tough and it was stressful, but there was a feeling that the society supported them. And I think that that's what's so demoralizing. Not only is the workload crushing right now in hospitals, but it's demoralizing to have to deal with people who are so angry at staff, medical staff, who are just telling it like it is. And in some cases, family members or patients demanding care that isn't supported by medical evidence and then becoming very angry about it. It's just it's a big issue. And I think that we're going to see a lot of people leave the healthcare profession over the next 6 months to a year because it is so stressful.
Let's move on. We have plenty to talk about, including the Des Moines Register reporting last week what we have been saying on this broadcast for several weeks now, that some Iowa Democrats are in what the Register called panic mode because their candidate for governor, Deidre DeGeer, has virtually no money in her campaign fund, while Governor Reynolds has nearly $5 million. And just this afternoon, Monday afternoon, you have an exclusive that the Register will pick up on about another Democrat who's decided can't make it happen, can't run for governor. Talk about that.
So State Representative Chris Hall represents part of Sioux City. He's been in the legislature for the last 10 years, and he was looking very seriously at the governor's race. I know a lot of people had encouraged him to run. He was seen as a rising star. He's the ranking Democrat on the House Appropriations Committee, and he just looked at this, and he told me today that he did not see a feasible path to put together the resources and the name ID that it would take to run a winning campaign. And he said that this is important to him, that the state is important, and he cares about what happens to Iowa, but he just didn't see a way forward. So I have heard that some other Democrats may be considering getting into the governor's race, but it's really late right now. There are only about 5 weeks left before the candidates for statewide offices have to submit their nominating petitions to the Iowa Secretary of State's office. So if you're running for governor, you would have to collect 3,500 signatures from Iowa voters, including at least 100 signatures from 19 counties. And so that's a tall order in itself. Then you have to raise the resources to put together a statewide campaign before the June primary. And then if you are victorious in the June primary, you're looking, staring down the barrel at Governor Kim Reynolds with her $5 million in the bank. So it's very daunting for Democrats. And I would guess right now that Deidre DeGeer is probably going to be the only candidate who files as a candidate for governor next March.
So Democrats, a couple have written in to the Des Moines Register saying Democrats owe it to Deidre DeGeer to at least, you know, give her some money and have her put up a campaign. What are the odds do you think that big money donors are going to weigh in on her campaign?
I just don't think so. I mean, if you look at in detail at her report, there are a lot of usual suspect Iowa Democratic donors who haven't given her any money at all. Then there are some who have given her in the $2,500 to $3,000 range, whereas in the past, those same donors might give candidates for governor $10,000 or $25,000. So I just don't think so. I think that it was demoralizing for Iowa Democratic donors when we had a lot of well-funded campaigns for the state legislature in 2020. The Democrats lost almost all of the targeted races in the Iowa House and the Iowa Senate. And I think that a lot of the donors just aren't willing to put money into these campaigns. And as we discussed last week, it goes much beyond the governor's race, because it's one thing for Deidre DeGeer to fall short against Kim Reynolds. But if the governor doesn't even have to spend any real resources on her own bid, she can turn that $5 million over to the Republican Party of Iowa, and they can spread it around to the other statewide candidates. And then if you're Attorney General Tom Miller, State Treasurer Michael Fitzgerald, or State Auditor Rob Sand, suddenly you're looking at an opponent who may have $1, $2, or $3 million to spend that they didn't even have to raise.
It is 15 and a half after the hour, wherever you are listening to us, and We're happy you're tuning in to us, KHOR Radio's Capital Week. I'm Dennis Hart with Laura Bell, and this is our anniversary show, beginning of our second year on the air in this time slot, where we talk about politics, Iowa style, and how it's affecting all of us. Thanks for joining us. The panel of National Republicans today, Monday, as we go live on Monday night, has given the green light to Iowa's first in the nation caucuses, Republican-wise, for 2024. This is the timing is interesting because, of course, this is a night tonight when caucus people are meeting across the state, Democrats and Republicans, in the off-year caucuses. So Republicans are in. They still want first-in-the-nation caucuses. Democrats, not so much.
Right. And remember also, the Iowa Republican caucuses do have a somewhat different process from Democrats. They have more of a straw poll where you go in, you write on a piece of paper the candidate you support for president, and if you want to, after that, you can leave. The Democratic process is much more cumbersome and time-consuming, breaking into preference groups. Then if you don't have 15% support in the room, you're not viable, and you have a chance to realign for another candidate. And so it can take a lot longer, and a lot of people complain about that aspect of it, because if 15% of your neighbors don't support the same candidate you support, then you can't register your voice for that presidential candidate. Whereas on the Republican side, you can just go in and write the name down on a piece of paper. So the Republican Party didn't recommend any changes, but I just want to make clear that their process is somewhat different. And in general, the Democratic concerns about the Iowa caucuses, the fact that it's so difficult for caregivers, shift workers, people with disabilities and other groups to attend, to be in a certain location at 7 p.m. on a Monday night, those issues are just not as salient in the Republican Party. There's not as much a concern about representation. The idea is that if you really care, you'll find a way to be there. And if not, well, you know, there's always the next caucus 4 years from now. So it's just never within the Republican Party. Also, in the national Democratic circles, people are very upset that Iowa and New Hampshire are overwhelmingly white states and not representative of where the country is as a whole. And again, that is not really a relevant issue in the Republican National Committee leadership. They're not really concerned about starting the presidential nominating process in more diverse, racially and ethnically diverse states. It's just not really a live wire on their side. So it was not surprising that the National Republican panel says, like, let's keep the caucuses the way they are. Does not mean that the Democratic National Committee is going to follow suit.
And we certainly hope those who are caucusing on this Monday night, again, as we go live, are listening to Capital Week. Let's talk about what the legislature did last week. They did a lot. The first major thing they did, the House passed its first bill, and it was requiring gas stations to offer gasoline with higher blends of ethanol at the pump. It was a bipartisan vote, and it was a big win for Governor Reynolds.
Yeah, they moved on this one quickly, and it was also a big win, I would say, for House Speaker Pat Grassley. He's very close to the agricultural interests. He comes from a farming family, and the big ag interests really wanted this bill, and they got it done quickly. I don't know how quickly it's going to pass the Iowa Senate, but they sure got it through the House. And I was surprised to see how many Democrats voted for it. It passed by a vote of 82 to 10. Of those 10, only three were Democrats who voted against it. There were seven Republicans who voted against it, reflecting the way of thinking that we talked about last week, the Koch brothers and other people who feel that mandates are wrong, that the market should decide, and that this is just a bad idea for the government to pick winners and losers in this kind of a way. So, but that turned out to be a fairly marginal view within the Republican caucus in the Iowa House. Only seven people were willing to go on the record and vote against this bill.
So do you think the Senate's going to pass this one?
I think they will. They may tweak it a little bit, but I think that with this kind of a strong bipartisan vote, I think that that shows it's much more likely to pass the Senate than not. Last year, this was discussed, and it never came to a vote in the chamber, and because there was so much opposition from business groups, including trucking companies, gas retailers, and I just don't know that they have the clout to stop this train from moving.
Governor Reynolds also released her plan for education last week. In it, she's calling for school districts to publish their curriculum and lists of library books online. Wants to let some parents use taxpayer money to send their kids to private schools. A variety of things. And state senators took it up last week. And so a lot of moving parts on this one. But the bottom line is, I wonder what you think in terms of how much she's going to get from both houses here. Where do you think this goes?
Well, she's made a few concessions on the siphoning public money to private schools. This was a bill. Last year, she had a plan for education savings accounts, which other people would say is very similar to what would commonly be known as a voucher plan. The Iowa Senate passed it last year along party lines mostly. The House, it didn't come to a vote because they didn't have the votes to pass it. This year, the governor has changed that. There was concern that in rural areas where there are no private schools, that this proposal would just take money away from the public school district, and yet it wouldn't give families a choice because there is no local private school to send their kids to. So the way this thing is structured now, some extra money would go to small rural school districts. And so I think that is an attempt to buy off some of the opposition in the House Republican caucus. And we'll see how well that goes. The governor really wants this part of the bill. I think the other parts, the publishing, the library catalogs online and so on, and curriculum online, that the Republicans will, I think, almost certainly pass. I don't know. Again, it's not as big a change as people realize. I mean, it's very easy for parents to find out what curriculum is being used in their children's classes already. So I would say that those changes are more cosmetic, but the education savings accounts and directing some public money to private schools, that would be very, very significant.
Meanwhile, State Senate President Jake Chapman filed a bill. We're going to have to start calling him the Education Avenger because that's apparently what he wants to be. He filed a bill that would let parents sue schools and have teachers and administrators face criminal penalties for distributing obscene material or hardcore pornography to students. We know that Republicans nationwide want to use education as a wedge issue this year, and Senator Chapman seems to be right in the forefront of that.
I think there's a feeling in some Republican circles that the way Chapman has handled this issue has not been helpful to them, that they liked what happened in the Virginia governor's race. They felt that the Republican candidate there talked about this issue the right way. But when Jake Chapman came out on the first day of the legislative session and said, some teachers have a sinister agenda and we need to protect our children from this agenda, it lost some credibility. And there, even as we discussed last week, the Senate Majority Leader, Jack Whitaker, threw cold water on the idea that they're going to pass a law to create criminal penalties for teachers and librarians who distribute this kind of material. So I felt that Jake Chapman, maybe by introducing this bill, he was trying to show that he wasn't deterred and he's going to stand his ground. But I don't think this is going anywhere, not if the Senate Majority Leader doesn't want this kind of a bill to pass. And it sounds like the governor also is not that interested in going in the direction of criminal penalties for Iowa teachers.
So that was my next question for you. Is this for show, what he's doing?
I think it is for show. I mean, he's in a very tough Senate race. He's running in a swing district, a suburban district, very different from where he's been elected before. It's going to be probably one of the most expensive Iowa Senate races. And he's decided that this is going to be one of his main issues, that he's out there in his wording. He's out there protecting children from forces that would try to corrupt them in schools. And he's taunted people on social media to say, well, if you think these books are so great, why don't you publish the images? Why don't you publish the offensive section? So there, he's taking a few passages or pictures out of context in a broader book and trying to make it sound like this is not appropriate material. And again, I should also mention that parents already have the ability to say they don't want their child reading a certain book that's assigned in a classroom. They can get an alternative reading. And most of the books that Jake Chapman is objecting to are not even assigned reading in any classes anyway. These are just books that were available in the library to be checked out, and he doesn't want them to be available to be checked out. So I don't think that his bill is going anywhere. I think that he wants to be seen by a certain part of the Republican base as one of their strongest advocates for protecting children, and that's going to be the message that we hear from him.
Also last week, State House Republicans were moving to shorten the length of time that Iowans can receive jobless benefits by 2.5 months. It's a House bill, and if it becomes law, the state would go from offering 26 weeks of jobless benefits to 16 weeks. So what do you make of this?
Well, I was very intrigued by this because last year, one of the bills that didn't get through the Iowa House, it got through the Iowa Senate again, but not the Iowa House, they did not have 51 Republican votes to pass it, was similar, that it would reduce unemployment benefits. There was a delay in when you would start receiving them. Right now, if you are jobless because of a business closure, you can get an extra 13 weeks. That would go away. And those elements are in this new bill as well. And then the governor has introduced this additional idea, which is cutting the maximum eligibility from 26 weeks to 16 weeks. And so we'll see. Like I said, they did not have the votes last year to pass this other bill slashing unemployment benefits. So maybe the governor can persuade them to go even further down that road this year. Perhaps there's going to be some horse trading behind the scenes in the House Republican caucus. I don't know, because it was never voted on the floor. I don't know exactly which Republicans objected to this idea of cutting the unemployment benefits. So we'll see. They need 51 votes. They're sure not going to get any votes from the Democratic caucus. So they have 60. They can afford to lose 9 people on this unemployment bill.
We have only about 3 minutes left. We're really zooming fast tonight. Senate Republicans advanced their proposal last week for individual and business income tax cuts through the Ways and Means Committee. It's going to be eligible for floor debate this week. There's going to be a tax cut bill that comes through both the State House and Senate. The only question is going to be, what's it going to be?
Right. I mean, the income tax cuts, I think certainly something is going to happen. The two big questions are the corporate tax cuts. Is that going to be included? The governor wants another corporate tax cut that would amount to about $300 million. The Senate is on board with that. So far, House Republicans are not supporting that. They have implied that they don't think that's sustainable. So that's one big question. The Senate also threw a bit of a curveball in there. Right now, most communities have passed a 1-cent local option sales tax, and the Senate bill would replace that, would rescind all those local option sales tax, replace it with a statewide 1-cent sales tax increase. And so consumers wouldn't see any change. They would pay the same sales tax. But because it would be statewide instead of local option, it would fund this natural resources trust fund that Iowa voters approved in 2010 in a referendum. 3/8 of that 1 cent would go toward filling that trust fund. And that is something that's controversial within both caucuses. And so I don't know whether the House Republicans are going to be on board. It's not something that the governor had proposed this year, but it's similar to something she proposed last year. So I think that she would go along with it. But in the environmental community, that's something that's being watched very closely right now.
Meanwhile, we have about a minute. Democrats unveiled their tax plan that focuses on reducing taxes for middle class and low income workers, in part by expanding tax credits for parents, low income workers. That one has virtually no chance.
Right. I mean, every bill that Democrats introduce in this legislature essentially is a dead letter. So, I mean, they're just trying to show that we could spend this kind of money. If we're going to spend hundreds of millions of dollars on tax cuts, we could do it in a way that primarily benefits people lower down on the income scale, people who would spend the money right away and stimulate the economy that way, as opposed to giving a lot of tax breaks to high-income people, wealthy, retired people who are likely to just stash it in a savings account.
So what do you expect this week? What's coming up in the legislature this week?
Again, I just think they're going to be moving a lot of bills through committee. We're getting closer to that first funnel deadline where bills that don't relate to spending or taxes have to get through at least one Iowa House or Iowa Senate committee, or else they're going to be dead for the year. So I just expect a lot of different bills on a lot of different fronts, probably some more education bills.
Laura, we are just about out of time. It has been a fine birthday broadcast. This is the start of our second year, and I have to tell you, it has been a true privilege, and I mean this, working with you these 52 weeks, and I'm looking forward to another 52. You are a delight to work with.
Oh, and same to you, Dennis. I really enjoy. I look forward to the show every week.
As I do. Laura Bellin, who is really one of the great political reporters in Iowa, we are so fortunate to have you on this broadcast. Let's do it for another year. What do you say?
Absolutely.
You have been listening to Capital Week on KHY Community Radio. A reminder, as always, that the views and opinions expressed here did not necessarily reflect the opinions of KHY or its staff. Laura and I will Zoom right back here in this time slot next week when we will have the latest on what's going on politically inside and outside the state capitol. Until then, we cannot thank you enough for the privilege of your time. We appreciate it. We truly value it. We know you have other things you could be doing. Between now and next time, we hope you have a safe, healthy, and happy week.